True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
I don't know what precisely woke me up, but what I heard were loud voices. Something bad was going on. So I grabbed that Little League baseball bat and I ran upstairs.
He wanted to shut me up, so he covered my mouth and then he started choking me. But at some point when he stopped, I screamed and then he started again. The next thing I remember is my dad standing in the doorway.
He has his hands around her neck and I said, "Let her go." And he said, "I'm going to kill her." And my thought was, if he gets into the bathroom, if he gets that door between me and him, then she's dead and there's nothing I can do about it. And so I reached around and I hit him in the back of the head with the baseball bat. I'm in the bathroom with him and I hit him again. I mean, I have room now. And I hit him hard in the back of the head again. He still got her by the throat, but he changes tactics. He decides to come back at me.
Jason just grabbed the bat away. It was like it was nothing. He could choke me with one hand and grab the bat with the other, and he was just so much stronger. And I was screaming, "Don't hurt my dad, don't hurt my dad." And I thought, he's going to hit my dad with the bat, and that's it. He's going to kill my father.
So I rush him, and I grab the bat with two hands, and I hang on for dear life. And I'm trying to hit him with the bat, and hit him with my elbow, and hit him with my fist, or anything else, but I'm going to hang on to that bat. And he goes down.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Jason Corbett grew up in Limerick, Ireland. When he was just 30, his first wife, Margaret Fitzpatrick, died from an acute asthma attack. Her death left Jason alone with two young children. Jason searched for a nanny online to help with his children after his wife's death. 24-year-old Molly Corbett lived in Knoxville, Tennessee, but she moved to Limerick and became their nanny. Before long, Jason and Molly began a romantic relationship. Molly was a wife and a mother of two, virtually overnight. Jason was a big, burly Irish man, always the life of the party and smiling. Holly fell in love with him and his children. The two became engaged in 2010 and they married in 2011. This story should have read like a fairy tale. The family moved to North Carolina when Jason was promoted at work, and they lived in a beautiful 5,000 square foot plus home with room for Molly's parents to stay overnight on visits. But something went terribly wrong in the early morning hours of August 2, 2015. Molly and her father would claim that violence erupted when Jason attacked Molly, but Jason's sister Tracy would write a book claiming that Jason was a victim of Molly and Thomas Martin's, a father and daughter bent on destroying Jason. Today, in Blindsided, we will attempt to sort out the truth of what really happened to Jason Corbett.
So you might have thought that I'd pick an Irish beer since we're discussing an Irish citizen. But, yeah, there's always a but. The crime occurred in North Carolina, where they were living, so I have a North Carolina beer.
Now, is this a new one? Because we've done a lot of North Carolina cases.
I know.
But this is a new beer?
Well, they brew more than 10 beers in North Carolina.
Okay.
However many North Carolina cases we've done.
All right.
Yeah, this is an exciting one. This one is called Snozberry. It's brewed by Green Man Brewery out of Asheville. And it's a wild ale. One of those sours that you like so much.
Thanks for picking that out.
So this is a cool beer. It's got a hazy maroon color. And it's typical for wild ales. It doesn't have much of a head. A pretty aroma of berries. Kind of a sharp aroma. Kind of acidic.
This is right up my alley, Dick. You're speaking my language here.
I know. And it's obviously going to be tart. So tart, sour berries. And I can't really pick out individuals. So it's raspberries, blackberries, etc.
Snozberries.
And whatever a snozberry is. And you get some oak on the taste. So this is one of those really nice wild ales. That's highly rated. And it just puckers you up when you drink it. Good one.
All right, let's open it. I can't wait.
I know. That's why I got it for you.
All right.
All right, let's have it.
All right, let's saunter on down to the quiet end with big smiles on our faces because we have a sour today.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about a horrible case.
It's a sad case. It really is.
It sure is.
Unexpected.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Most unexpected.
Yeah, this old Molly, young Molly, turns out to probably be some kind of psycho.
Okay.
But we'll see.
Let's save our judgments.
Okay. So Jason Corbett grew up as one of eight children. There were six boys and two girls in this family. The youngest were the twin boys born in February 1976, and they were Jason and Wayne. Their parents, John and Rita, both came from the Prospect area of Limerick, and their two families were next-door neighbors. Jason's father had attended the same Leamy school as Frank McCourt, who we all know as the author of Angela's Ashes.
What a wonderful book.
Very good book.
Mm-hmm.
Also a sad book.
Yes.
So Jason and his siblings were born and raised in Janesboro, Limerick. When they were growing up, they had open fields for playing. They had plenty of friends. Dad was a truck driver, and Mom was a typical Irish mom staying home to raise the children. Now, Sister Tracy, who's the one who writes the book, said that Mom was a typical Irish mama. She was the center of her children's lives, and their home was always warm and safe. Jason's mom became sick when Tracy was in her teens, and she had to stay in the hospital for a while. And Tracy's earliest memory of her brother Jason was of him helping her teach their brother Wayne to walk. Jason had learned first because Wayne had been a little ill after his birth and had a little bit of a delay developmentally, but he picked that up.
Mm-hmm.
But Jason was the first to walk. And Jason and Tracy were both kneeling in the hallway, holding their hands out while Wayne practiced walking. And he got the hang of it pretty quickly.
It's a nice image. Well, Jason made a friend at school who was critical for him in later life, Lynn Shanahan. And Lynn introduced Jason to Margaret, they called her Mags, Fitzpatrick. That's Jason's first wife. In 1997, Lynn and Jason were both going to a birthday party, and Jason approached Lynn to ask about her beautiful co-worker, Mags Fitzpatrick. Mags was beautiful, but she was also very kind, very warm. Jason was immediately crazy about her. He showered her with flowers, cards, and invitations to go out to dinner and to see movies. And it kind of seemed like love at first sight, at least on his part.
At least on his part. Mags wasn't that excited about him initially, although she quickly warmed to him.
Yeah. He was someone who kind of grew on you, from what I've read and heard. Mags and Jason had their first date on the day of Princess Diana's funeral. They moved into an apartment together that year and became engaged while they were on holiday in Barcelona. That was in 2002. Their wedding was in 2003, and it was held in the Star of the Sea Church, looking out onto the Atlantic, and it was hosted in the Bellbridge House Hotel. In September 2004, their son Jack was born. And Jason was just bursting with pride about his new son. As soon as Mags got home from the hospital, they both took a CPR class so they'd know how to be good parents if anything happened. They'd be ready for an emergency. Jason was already planning on being the rugby coach for Jack's future team. In September 2006, their daughter Sarah was born. Then, at the height of their happiness, just 3 months after Sarah was born, tragedy struck the family.
In November of 2006, Mags woke Jason to say she was having an asthma attack, which she's had. And she had asthma.
Yes.
It wasn't an attack out of nowhere.
No, and pregnancy can kind of worsen it. She just was finished with a pregnancy. She'd given birth recently.
Right. So she had decided to use her nebulizer, but then quickly realized it wasn't helping. So Jason called an ambulance, but instead of waiting for the paramedics, he stayed on the phone with them as he drove Mags towards the city to meet the ambulance on its way. As Jason pulled into the agreed meeting spot and was told the ambulance was almost there, Mags suddenly slumped forward onto the dashboard. Jason pulled her from the car and began CPR. Then the paramedics, who arrived minutes later, took over her resuscitation. At the hospital, Jason was taken into a private room by a doctor and told that although the paramedics had done everything they could, his wife had died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital.
Well, when you die of asthma, it's that you can't get the air out of your lungs.
Right, but you're still not aerating.
Well, yes, I know that for sure.
So, yes, maybe you can get a breath in.
You have air full of carbon monoxide that you can't get out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen is eventually it's going to slow the heart down and your heart's going to stop. So you could say that the cause of death was cardiac or heart failure or something, but that was secondary to the asthma attack.
Right. So poor Jason, he was a widow at age 30. His daughter Sarah was only 12 weeks old.
Yeah, can you imagine?
And
you
no,
got
it's horrible.
A two-year-old and a newborn, and you're just 30, and you don't have a mother
right.
or a wife. Wow.
Yeah. After the funeral, Jason's sister and her husband helped him out with the children. Jack and Sarah became Jason's primary reason for living. He decided that he would look for outside help with the children because he wanted to ease the burden of his extended family, because they had their own lives, their own families. He wanted to find someone to do the daily washing, cleaning, and cooking around the house, and just be there for the kids. So he advertised for an au pair, and over less than a year, he had a Spanish girl and a Czech girl work as live-in nannies. But there were problems with the language differences, and the girls weren't planning on long-term arrangements living in Ireland. So Jason decided that he would advertise for an English-speaking nanny to help care for Jack and Sarah on a more long-term basis. And that's how he would end up meeting and falling in love with Molly Martins. Molly was just 24, and she was the only daughter of Thomas and Sharon Martins. Molly had three brothers, Robert, Stuart, and Connor. Molly was the second oldest, and the family lived in Knoxville, Tennessee. They had a pretty luxe, kind of luxurious life. Their home had a swimming pool and six bedrooms. It was professionally decorated and landscaped. So she was used to the good things in life.
Yes, she was. So her mother, Sharon, was an educated woman. She had a degree in something.
Okay.
But she...
She had a college degree.
She was a college graduate. And I think she did work for a while. But then once she started having kids, she chose to stay home with her kids. Her husband, Tom, was a graduate of Emory and had retired from the FBI after serving more than 30 years with them. And he retired basically because he had to. You age out at the FBI. So he wasn't ready to stop working.
So was he an actual field agent?
He was.
Wow. Okay.
Now, after retiring from the FBI, he went to work in the counterintelligence section of the U.S. Department of Energy facility at Oak Ridge in Tennessee.
So more of a desk job.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't out shooting people or anything like that, but he was dealing with a lot of other agencies.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was more of a desk job.
Well, Molly arrived in Ireland for the first time in March 2008. And she was beautiful to look at. She had a slim figure, blonde wavy hair, and she really did have a beautiful big white smile. She had first emailed Jason in early February to tell him that she was interested in the job. Molly claimed she was a qualified Montessori teacher. She also said she was a graduate of Clemson University and had been working towards a place on the U.S. Olympic swimming team. Now, I know in 2020 she said she was planning to be a doctor. But a lot of these things don't check out.
Well, she never graduated from Clemson.
No.
That's a definite. And she didn't have Montessori qualifications. She had falsified those.
Yeah.
And who knows? I couldn't find anything about the Olympic swim team. Although there isn't anything in her history that suggests that.
No. Well, Jason's family would later claim that Molly lied a lot on her resume. Whether certain things are true or not, Jason was impressed by her qualifications because he was very anxious to find an English-speaking nanny.
Well, you know, here's this attractive woman from the States who seems qualified, talks a good game. Why wouldn't you hire her?
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. And how do you take care of two little kids and work full-time? You really can't.
Yeah. I mean, Jason has an extended family.
He did.
But
yep.
He didn't want to be a burden on them.
You know, no.
They all had their lives to live. So it's not as if he could say, well, you're not married. Why don't you take care of our kids? Anything right. like that. So, yeah, he needed somebody. And here's Molly.
Yeah, and after she arrived in Ireland, the arrangement did seem to be working out well. She was really good with Jack and Sarah from the start, and the house began to operate more smoothly than it had with the previous au pairs. On Molly's day off, Jason encouraged her to tour Ireland and introduced her to his friends. Jason's friends and family really liked her. She was quiet and polite, but quite friendly. Over the months after her arrival, Jason seemed happier. Molly appeared to be very devoted to the children, so it became obvious to those around them that Molly and Jason were romantically involved.
From pretty early on.
Yeah, there are various stories. Some people said they slept together within days of her arrival.
The day of her arrival.
Yeah.
Now, that might be a story. She certainly denied it, although she didn't deny it vehemently.
No, she didn't.
But there's no question that they fairly quickly became romantically involved.
Yes, and it was kind of everything Molly was looking for. It was a ready-made family.
Right. You know, so she's got a husband with an excellent job. Two kids already, so mm-hmm. she doesn't have to get pregnant.
Right.
Right?
Everything's been done for her.
Yeah. So Molly went back to the United States by herself in the summer of 2008 after she had started working for Jason. And when she returned, she and Jason began talking about moving into a house that would be their own and wouldn't have so many memories of his late wife. Pretty soon, Molly began complaining to Jason that she was homesick and hated life in Ireland, particularly the weather. I guess nobody likes the weather except the Irish people that live there.
It's kind of rainy and
cold,
beautiful
and rainy.
Though.
Yeah, it is.
Some really lush greens.
So Molly believed that a move to the U.S. would offer them all a new start and much better opportunities later in life for Jack and Sarah, Jason's kids. So then Jason said, okay.
Yes, he was quite accommodating. But most men are when they're in love, right?
That's right. So after selling Jason and Mag's old home, Molly set her sights on a move back to the United States. Jason loved the United States, and he's been there before. He's been here before, because we're in the States, right?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. Jason's life was an Irish version of the American dream, success earned by hard work. Jason and his first wife, Mags, had spent their honeymoon, actually, in the United States, in the Northeast, Boston, Cape Cod, New York State, and they never stopped talking about it. So he's not averse to moving.
No.
And he thinks it'll keep his wife happy or make her happier to do that. And yeah. As you said, who wouldn't want to do that?
Well, I don't think his siblings were too thrilled that he was leaving the country, although they seemed to understand.
Well, I think some of that also is they were already beginning to get inklings about Molly's mental state or her behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And there are inklings, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Of course.
That maybe things weren't as they seemed in the marriage, so they probably weren't real happy about that anyway.
No.
Now, Jason's employer, MPS, was very supportive after Mag's death, and they soon became a vacancy for a plant manager at their North Carolina location, which would be ideal, because Molly's parents live in Tennessee.
Ideal for Molly.
Jason knew that if he applied for the transfer, he had a very good chance of getting it. And from Molly's point of view, it was perfect. It was just 5 hours' drive from her hometown of Knoxville.
So at the urging of his sister, Jason actually consulted a counselor. And then he decided that he should follow his heart and move to the U.S. with Molly. Jason explained to his sister that Molly wouldn't stay in Ireland and she'd actually given him an ultimatum. If he didn't follow her to the U.S. as she demanded, he had a risk of losing her. Jason was also thinking not just of himself, but of his children. Molly had become like a mother to them, and he didn't want them to lose another mother figure. So Jason proposed to Molly on Valentine's Day 2010, and they immediately told his family and friends. They tried to look happy and delighted, but some of them were shocked. It seemed really fast, and like you said, they were starting to have some doubts about Molly. Their wedding was planned for 2011, and Jason's siblings felt like Molly was trying to erase all traces of Mags from the children's lives. Jason was following Molly's rules, convinced he was engaged to this glamorous younger woman, and he couldn't afford to lose her.
Their wedding was held at a place called Bleak House in Tennessee. Bleak House is a beautiful place, and it would have been almost impossible to find a more magical spot for a wedding. It was an outdoor wedding. The staff had arranged for lanterns to be hung from the trees and shrubs. Fairy lights were sprinkled throughout the greenery from each tier of the garden. There was soft music playing in the background. The food was delicious, the service impeccable, and the staff couldn't do more to help guests enjoy their day. Dinner was served on a terrace with Bleak House as the backdrop, and it was truly impressive. The house was chosen by Molly and her father, Tom. It had been the headquarters of the famous Confederate General James Longstreet during the battles of the Tennessee campaign, and it was also the base of the local chapter of the Daughters of the Confederacy. The ceremony was hugely expensive because Molly wanted the full fairy tale wedding. And Jason had actually given almost $50,000 to Tom Martin's towards the cost of the wedding.
So Molly caused kind of a scene at the wedding, right?
I think it was more than a scene. It almost wrecked the wedding.
Yeah. Care to elaborate?
Well, Molly seemed to have had some erratic moods, and Jason would eventually learn that she had a history of bipolar disorder.
Yeah, but one of the kids had a McDonald's cup, walked by with a McDonald's cup or something, and she started screaming?
Yeah, it was just some minor incident. And then she took off on one of Jason's brothers-in-law or something, one of Jason's relatives, and Molly just lit into him about some insignificant thing.
Okay.
And it took all the effort to get her to calm down and go through with the ceremony.
Well, Jason knew that depression and mental illness issues impacted thousands of families, so this didn't make Molly a bad person. With support and proper treatment, people can lead full and happy lives.
Of course.
He was determined that his support would help Molly. But rather than be open about her issues, Molly seemed to have been spending the years trying to hide them. And she only revealed part of the truth to Jason. She didn't go into the details of her previous relationships, or that she had been in an Atlanta psychiatric clinic just weeks before she traveled to Ireland in 2008. Molly's mental health issues dated back to her teenage years, but Jason was given the impression by her that they'd only been an issue for a short period of time.
Yeah, and she had been more heavily medicated.
Yes.
Before she met Jason, and had weaned herself off of much of the pills. I'm not sure she's even taking any medication when she was with Jason.
And that can be a disaster.
Well, yeah, because as you've said, with proper treatment, which would include medication, you can have a productive life.
Yeah, it was interesting that Jason's sister Tracy wrote about how she found an 11-page typed essay by Molly, and it had inserts of handwritten letters, and it also had a separate diary about her father and his depression and her parents' relationship. So this essay was entitled Molly's Inferno, and it was apparently written as some kind of a school assignment. And in it, Molly writes about trying to help two abandoned and abused children through social services. She also wrote about meeting a young woman who was being punished in hell for leaving two small children to suffocate while strapped in their car seats. So this was kind of a delusional, scary document. It was dominated by images of pain and death. Most alarmingly, to Tracy, the death of children, because this woman is caring for two young children now.
No, that would raise some red flags, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It was a little bit concerning.
Yes, it was.
Shortly before Molly left Limerick for the U.S., she gave Tracy a book as a gift, and this book was called A Reliable Wife. Tracy didn't know right away when she got it, but she would discover that this book was about a woman who planned to murder her husband. So here's the synopsis of the book. We looked it up. In the bitter cold, Ralph Tewitt, a successful businessman, stands alone on the train platform waiting for the woman who answered his newspaper advertisement for A Reliable Wife. But when Catherine Land steps off the train from Chicago, she is not the simple, honest woman that Ralph is expecting. She is both complex and devious, haunted by a terrible past and motivated by greed. Her plan is simple. She will win this man's devotion, and then, ever so slowly, she will poison him and leave Wisconsin as a wealthy widow.
That's alarming, too.
It is, right? What Tracy learned about Molly really led her to believe that her brother's murder was planned by Molly.
I think it could have been.
Yeah, definitely. We'll get into that.
We will. So by the time of the wedding, Jason had applied for his transfer from Limerick to the MPS plant in North Carolina, and he was accepted, or given the job. He enjoyed this new challenge. He made friends within the plant, and he got involved in all the MPS social activities, which included sports and barbecues. Molly and Jason purchased a home at Panther Creek Court in Wahlberg, which was a community about halfway between Lexington and Winston-Salem. Gorgeous house in a gated community. He paid almost $400,000 for it. Then he gave Molly an additional $80,000 to furnish and decorate the house. So he's in for a fair hunk of change right now. The house was purchased. There wasn't a mortgage or anything like that. So that was a house purchased free and clear with a $400,000.
He was doing well.
And he forked over almost $50,000 for the wedding and another $80,000 to furnish the house. So let's see, that's over $500,000.
It is.
That he's paid.
But, I mean, what's too much? You're talking about his wife, his children, his life. It's all going to good causes.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that. It's just a hunk of money.
It's a hunk of money. The property had a spacious basement bedroom that could be used for guests. Mostly, Tom and Sharon Martins used it, and they became regular visitors. Jack and Sarah both made the adjustment to life in the U.S. very well. They made friends in the community, and Jack became a very talented swimmer. Now, Molly really loved to dress up Sarah, and Sarah showed up at school each day, wearing pretty much a new dress every day. She was quite the little fashionable girl. Just 4 months after the wedding, Molly secretly visited a North Carolina divorce lawyer, and she asked what her rights were to Jack and Sarah. She was told that while she was Jason's second wife and had rights to his property and financial assets in the U.S., she was not the children's natural mother, and therefore the children would, in any divorce, go to the sole custody of their father. Molly claimed that Jason had promised to sign adoption papers, giving her equal rights to Jack and Sarah. So this was an issue that Tom Martins would repeatedly raise with Jason. Tom would later claim that Jason had promised to sign the papers as part of his marriage commitment. But on this issue, Jason did not budge. There was no way that Molly would be allowed to adopt his children. He even placed Jack and Sarah's passport in safekeeping outside the home. So this is kind of an underlying issue with these two,
well,
which
I
find kind of strange.
But I think the other telling thing is already 4 months into the wedding, into the marriage, Jason doesn't want to be married to her.
Well, no, he didn't say that.
Well, not in so many words.
He just didn't want her to adopt the kids. So maybe he was just afraid that she wouldn't stay with him.
No, he's already having second thoughts.
He was
having second thoughts actually before the marriage occurred.
But he was in love with her.
Yeah.
But I find it really odd that she went to a divorce lawyer.
Well, she's already discussed with him, you know, signed some papers to give me rights to the kids, and he wouldn't.
Is strange, because if you really trust your partner, why wouldn't you let them adopt your children if their other parent is dead?
Exactly.
So that shows right there that he didn't trust her.
No. Like I said, he was ambiguous even before they got married. And at the wedding, one of his brothers or brothers-in-law, somebody took him aside at the wedding and said, you know, it's not too late to back out of this. And his response was basically, well, it is too late. I can't.
Yeah.
So he realized pretty quickly that he shouldn't have married this particular woman.
Well, you're right. It does seem like things went downhill quite quickly.
They sure did.
In November 2012, Jason sent an email to a law firm in Charlotte, North Carolina, asking for advice. I have been married to Molly for just over a year now, and we live in Forsyth County. We have lived here for just over a year. Is it possible to structure this that if I ever get divorced, he said he wasn't planning to, that the right to keep the children is with me over Molly? What would you need from me if we were to proceed? That gives you some idea how he's thinking. Although he said he wasn't planning to get divorced.
No, although he was planning on taking the kids back to Ireland.
Eventually,
and not coming back to the United States with the kids.
But not in 2012, he wasn't.
No.
That's what we're talking about here.
I know.
Okay.
So according to Jason's sister, Tracy, there are some incidents with Molly So one occurred on her visit to Jason's home in July 2013, when she found Molly's lithium and other medications just lying around in the bathroom in reach of the kids. There was another occasion when she visited them that she was sitting on the deck and Molly asked her if she wanted one of her special drinks. So she said yes, and she became pretty sick. And it was the only drink she had taken that evening. She was so out of it that her husband had to physically carry her to bed. And it took her 2 days to fully recover. So looking back, she became convinced that Molly had drugged her.
But why would she do that?
Because she's
a little
nuts.
Crazy. Yeah, okay.
And later on, another incident, Tracy was shocked when she heard Molly's family laughing about an incident when Molly had given one of her sedatives to her father after he had asked for an aspirin for a headache. And he almost had to be carried from the baseball game they were watching. Kind of strange that the family seemed amused by this story.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if she accidentally gave him that instead of an aspirin. Kind of sounds like she purposely did.
I don't think she did anything by accident.
Okay. Well, after Jason's death, his family learned from neighbors that Molly had been really waging a campaign to destroy Jason's reputation. She told several of the wives that she was friendly with that Jason was a drunk, that he neglected the children, and that he was violent with her. These admissions would often be accompanied by tearful scenes and a display of bruises. Jack and Sarah, the kids, later explained that Molly would inflict the bruises on herself. Sarah once walked in on Molly hitting herself with the handle of a hairbrush on her arm to cause bruises that she later told her friends Jason had inflicted. While Molly was spreading lies about Jason behind his back, she was telling him a totally different story. Molly wanted to move from Panther Creek Court because she said nobody there liked her. She also complained that people in the community were talking behind her back. But Molly's revelations also came with this realization among the neighbors that not everything she said was true. So she got kind of a reputation as someone who makes things up.
She certainly did. And she was emotional and erratic with the neighbors as well. So one neighbor said Molly was known to bend the truth on occasions. She had arguments with some of the neighbors, and her claims seemed to run totally contrary to the kind of person that Jason appeared to be. Now, we know that images can be deceiving, but several people in the community felt the claims just didn't ring true with the kind of person they knew Jason to be. On one occasion, several local men chatted about whether to bring the claims to Jason's attention. Tragically, perhaps, they decided not to. But I'm sure Jason knew what she was saying behind his back.
You think so? I don't know.
Yes.
How would he know if nobody told him?
Just the way people acted around him.
I don't know. That's a big assumption, Dick.
Okay.
It's possible, but I think I wouldn't assume that from what we know.
I'm thinking he did.
In December 2014, Jason sent texts to some of his siblings saying that he was about to come home to Ireland with his children. There was no mention of Molly coming with him. In Jason's emails, Tracy later found a record of his flight searches with Expedia for an August trip, which was conducted just 24 hours before he was killed. Jason's Facebook page was also full of clues about what was going on in their marriage in 2015. Less than 36 hours before his death, Jason posted his last message on Facebook, and it read, "People will question all of the good things they hear about you, but believe all the bad without a second thought." Jason wasn't normally the kind of guy who shared quotes or sayings on Facebook, and it was also odd that he posted at 11:15 p.m. on a Friday night. Jason and Molly had spent that Friday evening at a cornhole party, which is kind of a southern tradition where you throw the little beanbag through a wooden platform. Kind of like toss across, if you remember that game.
Well, we've played cornhole many times.
Yes.
In fact, we are undefeated champions, you and I, in the last family get-together.
We were good, yes.
We were.
I don't want to brag.
Actually, I think we were lucky that day, but that's okay. We did it.
Yes. So Jason and Molly had gone to a party where they played cornhole. And at that party, Molly had made some nasty comments about Jason's weight, embarrassing him in front of their friends. Because he was a little chunky.
Oh, more than a little. He was barely 6 feet tall and weighed over 250 pounds.
Yeah, but that's not cool.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that it's cool.
Okay. It's not something you do.
No.
No.
He certainly was on the chubby side.
Yes.
But, you know, you just don't do that.
No.
So one of the neighbors later wrote to Tracy, Jason's sister, Molly was belittling him, calling him a fat ass, saying he must have taken all the nutrition from his twin because he looked like he had eaten for two.
So that's just mean.
That's more than mean.
Jason actually left that party early and seemed pretty down, not like himself, because he used to be like the life of the party. But he was obviously hurt by Molly's mean comments. So he walked home alone. And the Facebook posting was written just a few minutes later.
Yeah, and just a day after that, Molly and Tom Martins murdered Jason and orphaned his children, Jack and Sarah. Then they claimed that the murder was done in self-defense.
So let's take a short break here for our sponsors.
Good idea.
Now, when I was binging The Keepers a while back, I finished, and I was left with this empty kind of feeling. After some reflection, I realized that what I wanted afterwards, more than anything, was a podcast to help me process what I just watched. Well, I have some excellent news. Now there's You Can't Make This Up, which is a new podcast from Netflix. It takes a look behind the scenes of the shows that everyone is talking about.
And the shows discussed include Making a Murderer, which is the story of Stephen Avery. This is a guy who became a suspect in a murder after being exonerated and exposing corruption in local law enforcement. And the interrogation of his nephew is one of the worst things I've ever seen. It's just horrendous.
No kidding. That's just upsetting. Other Netflix documentaries they've covered are Wild Wild Country, which is this crazy story of a 1980s sex cult, Evil Genius, the shocking story of a pizza delivery man who robbed a bank with a bomb strapped around his neck, and of course the Amanda Knox story.
In each episode, podcasters, journalists, and comedians chat with show creators to explore stories they edited out and find answers to your burning questions. You Can't Make This Up is available on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or your preferred podcast destination. Go ahead and listen, subscribe, and review now.
Jason Corbett was beaten to death in a prolonged attack and appeared to sustain an injury after he died. He suffered a minimum of 12 major blows to his head, with parts of his skull broken loose in two different areas. Molly and her father would claim that Jason attacked Molly that night. Molly said that Jason's daughter Sarah woke her in the night because she was having a bad dream. So Molly took the child back to bed, and when she returned to her bedroom, she said that Jason was in a rage. He attacked her, and he had his hands around her neck.
Now, Tom Martins and his wife had decided, kind of spur of the moment, although it turns out they were invited by their daughter Molly, and they arrived at the house, and they were spending the night at the house. So they're asleep in their finished basement bedroom, when Tom said he heard Jason attacking his daughter. Tom picked up a bat that he had brought with him as a gift for Jack and came to the defense of Molly. Tom called 911 after beating Jason to death with a bat. And Jason was also struck with a paving brick that somehow was in the room by Molly herself. So both of them participated in the beating of Jason.
Yes.
Now, North Carolina Chief Medical Examiner's Office Associate Pathologist Dr. Craig Nelson said the sheer extent of the damage to Jason Corbett's skull was similar to the degree of injuries suffered in falls from a great height or in car crashes. Jason had also suffered a broken nose and blunt force trauma not only to his back of his skull, but to his face, neck, and arm.
When a paramedic tried to help Jason, who was lying naked and blood-covered on his bedroom floor, he attempted to move his head, and he found the back of Jason's skull to be squishy. Policemen who arrived at the home that day carried Jason's two young children downstairs, advising them to close their eyes so they wouldn't see the blood stains that were on the walls and the floor from their father's fatal head injuries. Davison County Sheriff's Department officer Clayton Dagenhart saw blood on the walls, floor, bed, hallway, and bedroom. He was the first police officer to enter the master bedroom of the home, and as he walked into the property, a paramedic told him, "It's bad in there, real bad. It's a horrible scene."
Paramedics removed Jason's body, and the police officers went upstairs to determine if anyone else was on the property. So we know that both kids were, and they were sound asleep. They slept through this whole thing, which is probably fortunate.
So that kind of goes against the story that the little girl had been up.
It does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So the children were on one floor, and then Molly and Jason were on the floor below that, and the parents were in the basement below that.
Right.
So it's kind of strange that the parents would even hear anything.
It is. And it's also strange that the mother, you know, the husband got up to help his daughter because he heard signs of a struggle.
Supposedly, yeah.
But the mother slipped through everything. She was nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
I don't either.
Okay.
But that's the story.
Right. Yeah, in Molly and Tom's version of events, they were just acting in self-defense. But the evidence certainly didn't support these claims. For one thing, Jason's injuries were way too extreme. Also, Molly didn't appear to have been attacked as she said she had been.
Well, neither of them, neither Molly nor Tom, had any injuries that suggested there was a vicious struggle going on.
Right, exactly. Well, during the subsequent post-mortem examination, a pathologist moved Jason's scalp, and pieces of his skull fell right out onto the table. Pieces of his shattered skull had also been driven into his brain. This damage was so severe that a pathologist couldn't even determine the precise number of blows. It wasn't 2, it wasn't 4, it wasn't 6, and it wasn't 8, he said. It was at least 10 times that he was struck. And the only mark on Molly at the scene was this little bit of redness on her neck, similar to what you'd see with a sunburn. Molly also was asked repeatedly to stop rubbing her neck at the scene. Both Tom and Molly Martins refused emergency medical treatment at the scene. So how could a 39-year-old, 6-foot, 260-pound man grab his wife by the throat, then get in this life-and-death struggle with a 67-year-old retiree and not leave a mark on either of them?
Well, I know how.
Well, you're just saying there was no struggle.
Exactly.
Right. Now, Molly's clothing was torn, and there were no marks on her neck, and she had this little bracelet on her wrist that wasn't bent, damaged, or even scratched, despite this big ordeal that she claimed she had just gone through.
Right, and there's no marks on Father Tom either.
No. Now, Tom said he heard noises coming from an upstairs bedroom in his daughter's home early that morning. The noises sounded like a disturbance, so on the spur of the moment, he grabbed a metal baseball bat that he had brought as a present for Jack. He said he saw Jason holding his daughter by the throat when he got to the master bedroom doorway. According to Tom, he instructed Jason to immediately release Molly. He claimed that Jason then put his entire arm around his wife's throat, saying, "I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her." At this point, Tom said he used the baseball bat to defend himself and his daughter, and he pointed out that Jason was much bigger than either Tom or Molly. Both the father and daughter feared for their lives at this time, and Tom acted as any father would in the circumstances to defend his daughter.
And then defend himself.
Right.
Now, there's one other thing. He said that during this altercation or fight that Jason took the bat from him, and Tom fell on the floor and somehow got up, wrestled the bat away from Jason, and hit him some more.
That's laughable.
It almost is. I mean, if it wasn't such a tragic event,
sure,
you'd laugh at a story like that.
That's true.
So, and like we said, there's absolutely no evidence of any injury to Tom also.
And he was kind of a slight guy. He might have been strong, but he was in his late 60s and kind of slight.
Yeah.
Jason was burly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I saw there are pictures in the book I read by Tracy.
His sister. Mm-hmm.
And other than blood spatters on them or on their clothing, they look great.
Uh-huh.
Tom and Molly.
Yes. No worse for wear, as they say.
Not at all. So on January 4th, 2016, Molly and Tom Martins were ordered to appear before a Lexington court where they were formally charged with second-degree murder and voluntary manslaughter. So Molly and Tom both faced the two charges. The voluntary manslaughter charge was a fallback option for the trial if something disastrous happened to the prosecution case. The main charge was that of second-degree murder, which is essentially murder without premeditation. It differs from manslaughter in that for second-degree murder, the defendant must have used malice in the fatal assault. In North Carolina, the heaviest sentence for a second-degree murder conviction would be life imprisonment.
And I believe it was first degree. I believe it was planned.
I do too.
At least by Molly, if not by her dad.
I think that somebody, Molly or her father, or maybe both, but Jason was asleep in the bed, and that's where the assault started.
Yes. Well, after being charged, both Molly and Tom were released pending their trial, and they were never remanded in custody at any stage, either after the initial charge or during the entire trial. But to Jason's family, the decision to charge Molly and Tom was an important first public vindication for Jason. It was a message to the world that the story about a hero dad defending his daughter from her drunken, abusive husband was pure fiction.
It was. Jason's family was relieved that Tom and Molly were finally charged, but they were convinced the killing of Jason didn't occur on the spur of the moment. They felt it was planned to prevent Jason from returning to Ireland with the children. And just hours after being charged, Molly's on social media launching an attack on what she termed a level of slander, harassment, lies, and absolute corruption that she and her father had been subjected to.
Yeah, Molly repeatedly used social media to complain about the lies being told about her and to plead for contact with Jack and Sarah. She also kept posting photographs of the children. Molly's uncle, Michael Ernest, also used social media to advance Tom and Molly's case. He stressed that the father and daughter had cooperated fully with the police and had acted only in self-defense. But in one critical posting, he wrote, "In the early morning hours of August 2, 2015, Tom and Sharon were awakened suddenly to the desperate screams from their daughter Molly." That post was removed, though, in a couple of hours. Now, the reason that I point this out is because he insinuated that Sharon Martins was awakened by the noises from the bedroom overhead. But the defense would emphatically state in trial that Shannon Martins didn't even wake up, and she never left the basement bedroom that night.
In addition to calling Jason an abusive husband, Molly suggested that he had killed his first wife, and she said this was based on a confession from Michael Fitzpatrick, Mag's father, to one of her relatives. This was something that was not allowed to be in evidence at the trial.
Well, she also said that Jason enjoyed choking her, and that's why she thought that his first wife was probably killed by him. So Michael Fitzpatrick, Mag's father, insisted on going to a Limerick solicitor and making a sworn statement that he had never made such comments to Tom Martins, as Tom was now alleging.
Well, it wasn't Tom.
Well, that's what Tom said on 2020, that he was told that directly from Michael.
It wasn't. It was Michael Ernest, Molly's uncle, that supposedly Fitzpatrick confessed to.
But that's not what Tom said.
So, see, there's a contradiction.
Right. Tom alleged that he was shocked by the remark, and in hindsight, it made him fear for the safety of his own daughter. So in other words, this played, as he would understand very well, towards his state of mind at the time of Jason's killing. He claimed these comments had been made to him at Jason and Molly's wedding. But the only thing was, is that Michael had not attended the wedding.
And he said, I never said that.
Yeah, whether it was the father or the uncle, he said that he'd never said that, and he hadn't even been at the wedding.
Right. And he wanted to have, well, he did make a statement, a sworn statement, because he had died before the trial started.
The father.
Mag's father.
Right.
And the whole situation never got brought up in trial. The judge didn't allow it.
Well, living in Ireland with Jason's sister, Jack and Sarah were receiving counseling, and they made some disclosures about what had happened in the U.S. They explained not just what had happened in August 2015, but the behavior of Molly and Jason in the months leading up to his death. Tom Martins was being defended by David Freeman and Jones Byrd, and they were two of the best defense attorneys in North Carolina. Freedman specialized in serious criminal cases such as murder. Molly was defended by Walter Holton and Cheryl Andrews, also considered some of the best legal advocates in the state. Both Freedman and Holton asked for the trial to be transferred to Moxville in the neighboring Davie County, arguing that the publicity generated by Jason's death and the subsequent investigation made it impossible to put together an unbiased jury in Davison County. But the Moxville courthouse was actually undergoing construction work that July, so the change of venue was impossible. And the judge also noted that he was having a hard time seeing any local prejudice that would cause him to want to move the trial.
Right. Now, the trial formally opened on July 25th, which is a Tuesday. And this was the first time that people heard just how violent Jason's death had been. It also came out that traces of a powerful sleep medication, trazodone, which had been prescribed for Molly on July 30th, just a couple days before Jason's death, was found in his system. Jason did not have any issues sleeping. This also seemed like proof that what had happened to Jason was no accident, but was planned. And I could certainly see slipping that to him. He falls asleep, easier to bludgeon.
Yeah. Well, the prosecutor said that despite their 2011 marriage, Molly had been only a stepmother to Jason's two children by his late first wife, and that Jason was considering moving back to Ireland. He said that while Jason was discovered in the bedroom naked and blood spattered with a crushed skull, there wasn't a single visible mark on either his wife or his father-in-law when police and paramedics showed up. So this was despite their claim that they had acted only in self-defense that night. But Jason's injuries were just horrific.
They were. They were more than horrific. So Walter Holton, one of the defense attorneys for Molly, said that a strand of her hair was later found in Jason's dead hand. But this had not been preserved by forensic experts or analyzed at the scene. So while Mr. Holton attached a major importance to this fact, it was considered to be a non-issue. Holton also said police statements indicated that Molly was in severe shock at the scene.
The prosecution's first witness was Karen Capps, the emergency dispatch operator, who'd received the 911 call from Tom Martins at the scene. The two defense teams had objected to statements of how the 911 operator had perceived Tom's demeanor during the call. But she testified that Tom was calm, surprisingly calm, and he stayed calm throughout the call. He said he hit Jason in the head with a baseball bat. She had instructed Tom to check Jason's airway, to place him on his back and begin CPR until the paramedics could get there. And she noted that Tom didn't, at any time during this lengthy call, sound out of breath, despite the fact that he had been asked to do 400 chest compressions, which is normally a very exhausting task for anybody.
It sure is. It's quite tiring to resuscitate someone.
Yeah. Karen Capps also said that Molly came on the phone later, and she was very tearful. At one point, Molly was shouting out the CPR count. She counted like she was yelling, like she wanted to make sure I heard she was counting, Karen said.
In direct evidence, she confirmed she took the 911 call from Tom Martins at 3:02 in the morning on August 2nd. The 911 call was played for the jury, and Molly began sobbing, wiping her eyes and nose with a tissue. There was silence in the courtroom as the recording was played. One of the remarks by Tom seemed especially cold. When asked by the dispatcher if he was rested enough to take over CPR efforts on Jason from his daughter, he replied, "I guess I have to be." Seconds later, he told the 911 operator, "I'm not seeing any signs of life here."
It did sound pretty casual. You're not doing it justice, how casual he sounded.
Well, I'll try to be more blasé.
That's okay.
When police officers did arrive at the house, Tom's only apparent concern was for Molly. A nurse testified that Molly was prescribed trazodone 50 milligrams 3 days before her husband's death. The prescription was given after Molly apparently complained that she could not sleep due to a congenital circulatory problem with her left foot.
Yeah, trazodone is a pretty powerful sedative, isn't it?
It can knock you out pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was originally an antidepressant, but then it was found to really put people to sleep. So I think that's usually what it's prescribed for now, is sleep.
Yeah, it's really not prescribed for depressive symptoms.
No, but this drug was never prescribed for Jason, we should point out.
Right. But he did have some in his system. I think our feeling is that he was drugged and this was to aid them in killing him. That's where the premeditation comes into effect to me.
Oh, absolutely. That's how I see it. The medical examiner testified that at least one of the injuries to Jason's skull was sustained after he was already deceased. There was very little bleeding, suggesting that that was a post-mortem wound. His time of death was confirmed at 3:24 a.m., but it's not possible to determine precisely when his heart stopped beating.
No, the 3:24 a.m. is when he was pronounced dead.
Right, after they tried to resuscitate him.
Yeah.
Paramedics testified that when they arrived at the scene, Jason's body was lying naked in the master bedroom in a pool of blood. With no light on, it was difficult for the paramedics to see what they were doing. So it seemed odd that Molly and Tom had not turned on a single light when they were supposedly attempting to resuscitate Jason. Now, also, a lot of blood in the area was congealed and drying. So that, along with the coolness of Jason's body, made them wonder if it had been a while between when Jason was beaten to death and when Tom actually called for help. Also, Tom never mentioned the paving brick that Molly would admit to hitting Jason with. And Molly would explain that the brick had been on her bedside table because she and the daughter Sarah had a project that they were going to use it for.
Paramedic Barry Alpha confirmed that at no time did rescue staff get any heart rhythm from Jason. And he further stated that in trying to move Jason's head, he said he was shocked when his hand and fingers slipped inside the back of Jason's shattered skull. That's how severely he was beat.
Beaten to a pulp, really.
To a pulp.
Yeah.
Jason was so covered in blood, paramedics initially didn't know how severe the injuries were, because there's just this bloody mess lying there.
Well, Molly was found lying on her side on the ground outside of the house, and there was no significant injury to her. But Molly claimed she had been attacked. She stated that she had been choked. However, she refused all requests from the paramedic to go to the local hospital for medical assessment and possible treatment. Then Molly signed a medical refusal form.
Well, both she and her father did submit to pictures being taken.
Yes, I didn't see anything significant. Even the things that she claimed were bruises or scratches were nothing.
Right.
I mean, I would have worse than that on my body at any given day, just from everyday life. There were no real injuries.
Yeah, and you know, my thinking initially was I would have refused pictures also, but that would just make people suspicious of you.
Well, yeah, and they really should have gone to the hospital and allowed themselves to be examined if they were on the up and up. Why wouldn't you?
I would think. Former Davidson County police officer David Dillard stayed with Molly at his patrol car. He said he spent around 90 minutes with her as emergency services attended to the scene. She was also rubbing her neck in a scrubbing motion. She would do it, stop, do it again, stop again. He also testified that he heard crying noises but didn't see any tears.
Joanne Lowry worked with Tom at the U.S. Department of Energy facility at Oak Ridge in Tennessee. Both worked in a security unit that specialized in counterintelligence at the federal agency. And she was questioned by Assistant DA Martin about any dealings she had with Tom, about Jason and his big Irish family. She said it was common knowledge in the unit that Tom intensely disliked his son-in-law, Jason. And just weeks before Jason's death, he had told her that he hated his son-in-law. So Florida-based forensic scientist Dr. Stuart James' expertise helped to unravel what had happened in the master bedroom that night. He was one of the foremost experts in his field. He had written a book on blood spatter study that many now consider to be one of the key reference works for forensic analysis. He testified in more than 200 trials as an expert forensic witness. He was hired to help explain the extensive blood patterns that were found inside the Corbett house, and to study blood spatters found on the red polo shirt and white patterned boxer shorts that were worn by Tom that night. He also studied Molly's blue patterned pajama suit.
So shortly after Dr. James took the stand, Molly's and Tom's clothing was displayed. Each piece was pinned to a giant display board and brought close to the jury for examination. So Dr. James focused first on blood stains found on Jason's bed. The pattern stains were up on the bedding, and the saturation stain was further down on the skirting. So this meant that there had to have been an impact incident that took place there in the bed. This may very well have been where the bloodshed first occurred. So Dr. James said he believed the first blow may have been suffered by Jason while he lay there in bed.
Which would totally make it premeditated and go against their story. So the doctor addressed the stains on Tom's clothing. He said blood spatters on the inside lower hem of the patterned boxer shorts were different in direction from those on the front. The depth of penetration of the blood into the fabric would determine whether it was a spatter or a soak transfer. He said the blood spatters inside the lower hem were different from the spatters on the outside of the underwear. The source of the blood had to be from below then, so the blood droplets had to travel upwards. This would mean that Tom was standing over Jason when his head was violently struck. Some walls had large blood spray patterns, several from an impact-type transfer. This was from Jason's head hitting the wall after he had been struck and when he was falling to the ground. Most of the blood spray patterns were at lower heights, as if Jason was struck either when he was falling to the ground or he was trying to get back up. When Dr. James analyzed Molly's and Tom's clothing, he found some of the items were soaked, not just in Jason's blood, but with some of his tissue. Blood and tissue weren't just found on the walls and the carpet. It was found in Jason's bed, on the mattress, on the window blinds, the bedroom dresser, a lampshade, and even the vacuum. There was even a blood smear mark on Tom's watch. Jason's sister Tracy testified that Jason was planning to leave the U.S. and resettle in Ireland. Jason was homesick, and she knew he wanted to make the move back to Limerick before Jack started secondary school. All of this gave Molly motive because Jason didn't plan to return Jack and Sarah to North Carolina. He had communicated to his family that he was concerned about how Molly would react when he told her he was going home without her. The defense, of course, challenged her over Jason's travel plans, but she pointed out that he had researched tickets with various carriers to come home on the very morning he was killed. She had spent weeks tracking the information with the internet provider about Jason's travel plans. Tracy had found an online reminder where Jason had left a memo to himself not to forget to book the flights. She was convinced that he was going to fly home on August 2nd with that previous Friday night's humiliation by Molly being his final straw. But the defense kept repeating that no flights had been booked and that Jack and Sarah were scheduled to return to school in North Carolina.
And that's true, but there is a little interesting tidbit about that. She had, in fact, registered Jack and Sarah for school, but it was in a different area, 110 miles away, which also happened to be near her brother Bobby's house. So why would Molly be moving Jack and Sarah so far away from the home that she and Jason shared? The suggestion was that she had plans to move on with the children after getting rid of Jason.
Well, I really don't see any other explanation for that. Do you?
No, I don't.
And the jury didn't either.
No, they didn't. So the jury found Tom and Molly both guilty of second-degree murder, and both were sentenced to a minimum of 20 years and a maximum of 25 years. Well, I think they got away with stuff. I think there was premeditation, and they could have gotten first-degree murder.
Sure.
But anyway, 20 to 25 years. Molly addressed the court prior to her receiving the same sentence as her father. I did not murder my husband. My father did not murder my husband. The incidents of August 2nd happened as they happened on a somewhat regular basis. The only difference is my father was there. And at that point, she started crying uncontrollably.
But it really seems like she was just crying because she felt sorry for herself because she was going to prison. I don't think it ever occurred to her that she would be convicted.
Oh, no.
No. She thought she was going to get away with this.
Well, and if you watch the, is it 2020?
Yes.
If you watch that program that was taped before the trial, it just to me, and I hadn't read the book yet, by the way. So I went into watching that program with as open a mind as I can have anyway. And it seemed to me that she was playing for the audience.
Oh, absolutely. And Tom Martins declined to address the court. Others were invited to speak before the court prior to sentencing, and Assistant DA Alan Martin read a letter from Jason Corbett's son, Jack. So do you want me to read that? It's not very long.
Sure.
My father's death has been life-changing for me. My dad was always there for me, always cheering me on in sports, in school, and everyday life. He won't be there for me if I marry or have kids. He'll miss everything. He won't see me grow from a child to a teenager. I can never go to movies or pass a pass when playing rugby without feeling bad because that's what me and my dad did. We are now seen as the family of the Irishman who was killed in his home by a murderer named Molly Martins. One thing she is not and never will be is part of the Corbett family. My dad will not be forgotten. Molly Martins will also not be forgotten. She will be known as the woman who murdered her husband for no reason.
Molly was sent to North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women outside of Raleigh. And her father, Tom, was taken to Central Prison, which was also just outside Raleigh. The Central Prison was nicknamed CP and was home to some of the most notorious offenders in North Carolina, including many convicted of gangland murders.
Is that where Michael Peterson went, do we know?
Good question. I don't know.
Okay.
So in Lexington, TV crews conducted a series of interviews with some of the jurors who had convicted Tom and Molly. Jury foreman Tom Omland was one of those who gave interviews outside the courthouse, and he said the jurors fully accepted what the prosecution claimed happened that night. juror Miriam Figueroa told U.S. TV network ABC that she believed Molly Martins struck her husband first with the paving stone while he was sleeping.
I tend to agree with that from what I've researched about it.
Yeah, but I think he was asleep. He certainly wasn't choking his wife.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think she drugged him and clobbered him with the paving brick.
Right.
And then her dad came in and finished the job to kind of cover up for her. That's my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that she struck him a few times or sometimes with the brick and he was still living? So that's when she called her father to come help? Or
I don't know. I mean, that's hard to speculate.
It is.
But I do believe that he was blindsided.
Yeah. And he did get up out of bed because he was on the floor.
Yeah, and he was naked.
Yeah.
So the juror said that she thought at some point Tom Martins came to help cover it up. And I agree with that.
There was blood on the pillow and on the comforter. And that may have been the first blow. And then it progressed from that point where he gotten out of bed and he was struck repeatedly. And juror Tom Omland said he believed the extensive blood impact spatter marks were from the Irish father of two desperately trying to escape the attack.
Yeah, Tom and Molly were both interviewed, like you said, for 2020, both before and after. And they both accused Jason of being abusive. And Molly claimed that she believed Jason had killed his first wife, Mags, Margaret Fitzgerald. Which, if you were to talk to any of the witnesses that night, where he actually drove out and met the ambulance, it really doesn't seem like he had anything to do with it. He seemed quite distraught.
Yeah. How do you fake an asthma attack?
Yeah. If he'd strangled her, they would have known.
Right. They would have.
Yeah. Well, she tried to claim that he used to like to strangle her during sex or when he got angry.
Yeah.
They also had a tape of an argument between the two where he was yelling, but it wasn't anything extraordinary. He wasn't calling names or threatening. It seemed like just a bad argument that a couple had.
Yeah, it did. Molly and Tom appealed their convictions just this past month, noting that the prosecution never presented any evidence to contradict that Jason had choked her and that she was not the aggressor. No decision has been reached at the time of this recording.
But you mentioned to me that there was an earlier appeal that was denied. What was that about?
That was, I believe, just about some juror misconduct or something. There was something that they appealed right away.
Mm-hmm.
That got denied by the judge.
Okay. Well, for more information on this case, I would recommend the book My Brother Jason, which was written by Jason's sister Tracy. The 2020 interviews with Tom and Molly really paint a different picture, but the evidence just seems to go with what Tracy said in her book more than what Tom and Molly say in their interview. Now, of course, Tracy's his sister, so she's going to be very slanted to his side. But when you take the evidence into consideration, I certainly believe her more than I believe Tom and Molly. And the court did also.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. As you said, obviously there's some bias in the book because that's written by his sister who thought he was the greatest guy in the world. On the other hand, we've got the 2020 interviews that are slanted the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So I would certainly agree with you that the evidence that was presented lines up more with what Tracy, his sister, writes about in the book rather than what's discussed on 2020.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if she hits him in the head when he's sleeping, that's a really disturbed thing to do. So there's something really wrong with her.
Well, we've known that.
I mean, it's because it's not like there was an argument and she went into a rage, which can happen. But this was seemed like it was out of the blue, either planned out or she just had some kind of psychotic break in the night and decided to do that. I mean, another possibility is that her and her father planned the whole thing, which to me is pretty outrageous, but it is possible.
Oh, I certainly think it's possible.
Because the dad was in the basement. How would he even hear anything unless she had called him up there?
I know. Their bedroom was on the first floor.
Yeah.
So I guess possibly they could hear it in the basement.
So, but Sharon didn't? Molly's mom just slept through the whole thing, we're supposed to believe?
That's the other thing that's kind of hokey about this. That there was some reports that both parents had been wakened by this supposed struggle going on. And then they recanted that and said, no, it's just Tom. Sharon didn't have any awareness of what was going on.
Right. But it's pretty outrageous to think that this woman's, both of her parents, would agree to murder her husband, too, because, I mean, up until this point, as far as we know, these were law-abiding people. But on the other hand, it seems like Molly was a troubled person who they were always covering up for and saving from one thing or another.
I agree with that.
So it was kind of a codependent relationship.
Yeah. And I guess I suspect that her father, Tom, thought that by being in the FBI and in law enforcement for all these years, he could figure out how to get away with it.
Yeah, sure. I agree with that. But he didn't do a very good job, if that's the case.
Certainly not.
I mean, why wouldn't he at least injure himself or Molly in some way to make it look more real? It just, to me, it kind of shows a bit of cockiness.
Yeah.
That they thought they could pretty much get away with anything.
Right. Because if you had thought about it a little more carefully, and you're saying, well, this was a tremendous struggle, that Jason was trying to physically harm Molly, and Tom intervened, there should have been signs of more of a struggle in the room to begin with.
Yeah, definitely.
And there should have been signs on Molly and Tom of the struggle.
Right.
So I don't believe that.
No, well, in her whole story about the little girl getting up in the night, when the police and paramedics got there, that little girl was sound asleep.
Sound asleep.
Which you never know with kids. They can sleep through anything, but to me it's a little odd.
Well, yeah, I think it's doubtful that the child had woken and Molly had comforted her.
And that he had gotten angry because she was comforting the child? That
yeah.
Just doesn't seem like him from anything we've read.
No. He doted on his children.
Right.
Right? So he wasn't going to get pissed off.
No. Anything else you want to add on this case?
I think not.
Okay. The music for this podcast was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy True Crime Brewery and would like to offer some support while gaining access to members-only episodes each month, please go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber. Or you can also go to Patreon and become a patron. Tiegrabber members also receive gifts from us and our endless admiration and devotion. We just released a members-only episode a couple of days ago on the kidnapping of Shannon Matthews, which I like it. I think it's one of our better episodes.
That was fun.
I'm proud of that one. So if that's something you'd be interested in, we'd really appreciate it. Other ways to offer us some support are to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, to go on to iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast and leave a review. Or you could even join our Facebook True Crime Brewery fan discussion page, where people who listen to True Crime Brewery discuss the cases that we've covered, as well as other true crime that's in the news.
Okay, let's do feedback.
Okay.
We're into it. So we have one voicemail this week from Sarah, who has a case suggestion.
Okay, let's listen.
You play it and I'll talk about it.
Hi guys, you mentioned on your last episode you didn't have very many voicemails, so I wanted to reach out and mention something that's kind of been on my mind. I know it hasn't really been covered by a lot of true crime podcasts yet because it's probably too fresh. However, I'm from Jacksonville Beach, Florida, and a little over a year ago we had a scenario where the creepy rundown home on the corner ended up being the home to a murderer. Ronnie Hyde was arrested for the murder and dismemberment of a young boy, teenage boy, in 1994. Actually, the web sleuths are credited with connecting the dots, moving it along, and getting it to where it is now, which I think as a crime nerd is pretty cool, that their involvement really pushed things forward. The thing about Ronnie Hyde, though, is they don't think this was the first time. He's got a really weird background where he presented himself as like a mentor, a pastor to young boys and teenage boys that were in a really bad situation. So people that weren't really, you know, had their eyes kept on by many people. So they were really in vulnerable situations. And another thing that's weird with Ronnie is he never had an actual job anywhere, but he traveled quite a bit. So they are kind of thinking, if you dig a little bit, you'll see that, you know, dealing with these young boys, so much travel, so much international travel, they think that he, you know, because he didn't have an income coming in from anywhere, he was in a child sex trafficking ring. So they think it's going to end up being a lot larger than what it looks like now. So it will be something that you'll have to sink your teeth into and dig in real deep. But definitely something that will, you know, be a lot larger than what it's being presented to right now to the public. So yeah, dig in, dive in, enjoy. It's really interesting. He's not a good person at all, and looking forward to seeing how, you know, the hammer comes down on him. Yeah, thanks for what you guys do. Really enjoy your insight on everything and keep doing what you do.
So this was a cold case. The murder occurred in 1994 when Fred Paul Laster was found, or his remains were found, in a dumpster in Lake City, Florida. So, and it took some time, but they eventually arrested Ronnie Leon Hyde for the crimes. And he has not appeared in, the trial hasn't occurred yet. The child pornography stuff, they've added a dozen child pornography charges to the murder case. Hyde was a former youth pastor and had a lot of kids that he counseled. So there's as Sarah suggested, that there's a sex trafficking ring that he was involved in. So right now, he's just been charged with the death of Laster, but the law enforcement does fear that there are more victims, and they're hoping to get some more evidence for that. So we'll keep on top of that.
Well, what about his charges for the 12 different pieces of pornography? Each of those 12 forms of evidence has at least 10 or more images, including movies, of sexual performances by a child, according to a statement from the state attorney's office.
Right, so that those are other charges. They haven't taken in a trial yet.
I see.
So it should be something interesting.
Yeah, many of the titles of evidence collected were letters and numbers, although I guess three contain the names Cindy, Stephen, and Paul.
Yeah, and the FBI is not speaking publicly about the matter, other than to acknowledge that additional charges have been filed against Hyde.
Well, if you couple that with the murder charge, he does face a maximum sentence of life plus 180 years if he was convicted of all charges. So hopefully he won't be seeing the light of day.
It doesn't sound like.
No.
Does it?
No. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sarah. We always love a voicemail, especially with a good recommendation in it.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah. So we have some emails. We have one from Nikki, which is a case suggestion. And Nikki writes, I know I'm always recommending cases for you guys. Yes, annoying, I know. But I think you would love to talk about the murder of Donna Winger, murdered by her husband, Mark Winger. It's such a twist in the case and such a devious plot by the husband. You guys would find it very interesting to talk about, in my opinion. I can't go too much into the details because it's pretty involved. However, if you Google invitation to murder 48 hours, you can get a feel for the case. So what did you find on this case, Dick?
An interesting case. And I hope this isn't too long-winded. I'll try to hit the high points.
Okay.
But in August of 1995, Donna Winger had taken a ride from St. Louis International Airport to her home in Springfield, driven by a shuttle driver, Roger Harrington. So when she got home, she told her husband that Harrington had given her a hard time during the ride, talking about getting high and having orgies. So the Wingers complained to Harrington's employer. Then a few days later, Mark Winger called 911 saying that he had caught Harrington attacking Donna with a hammer and had shot him to death.
Wow, that's amazing.
Isn't it? Right then, I'm a little suspicious.
Of the Wingers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, at least of him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess I could say that Harrington might have gotten upset because he might have been reprimanded by his employer.
Sure.
But still.
But would he just go and attack a customer with a hammer, or do we think there's more to it?
That's what sounded weird. So police initially speculated that Harrington broke into the Winger's home and attacked Donna in retaliation for the complaint. But they did become suspicious of Winger because he continued to visit the police station to ask about the case, even after it had been initially closed. So I guess the initial story stood up, or at least was believed by the authorities, that came home and found Harrington attacking his wife, and he shot and killed Harrington.
So Donna died also?
Yep.
Because I read that he remarried his daughter's nanny, so that really brought some more suspicion on Mr. Winger, Mark Winger.
Yeah, well, they were suspicious about that. He hired a nanny 5 months after his wife died and married her. Boom.
So well, at least it wasn't before she died.
Right.
Then I'd be more suspicious.
That'd be a little tougher, right?
Mm-hmm.
So police eventually concluded that the position of Donna's and Harrington's bodies were inconsistent with Winger's account of a struggle with Harrington. They also found out evidence in Harrington's car that Winger had invited him to meet with him and his wife. So the new theory was that Donna's upsetting ride with Harrington inspired Winger to plot to kill Donna with a hammer and then shoot Harrington, using the story of an attack by Harrington as a cover.
That's kind of clever and devious.
It is, but it didn't work. So evidence introduced at trial included recorded conversations between Winger and Harrington arranging a meeting on the day of the murders.
I wonder how they got recorded conversations.
From a phone? I don't know.
Well, I know from a phone, but why would anyone be recording it?
Good question. Maybe Harrington recorded it because he was suspicious of Winger.
Yeah, maybe.
So testimony from paramedics that they had found Donna face down contradicted Winger's statement that he'd held his wife before they arrived, before the ambulance arrived. A close friend of Donna's testified she'd been having an affair with Winger at the time of the murder, and that Winger had tried to involve her in his plot, and that Winger had told her it would be better if she, that is Donna, died.
Well, now that kind of puts it over the top. That's pretty convincing evidence there. Is.
He sounds like a sweetheart, doesn't he?
Jeez, that is devious.
Yeah, it didn't work, though. And he was found guilty of first-degree murder of both Donna and Harrington and sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Well, let that be a lesson, kids. Crime does not pay.
It doesn't.
So now I have a comment from Karen B. on A Mom on Death Row, which is the Darlie Routier case.
That's one of people's favorite cases. They just keep commenting on it.
Oh, yeah. And it comes back on TV with specials all the time, too. It's a fascinating case because I do think she's probably guilty, but there's a lot of questions there, especially with the husband. But anyway, Karen B. says, Darlie's innocent. The detective work in this case was a joke. Her horrific full-arm bruising was just way more than what someone would do to themselves. Her arms were just black. She beat the hell out of the intruder. Her husband tried to get someone to rob their home for insurance purposes due to their money issues. How was that not thoroughly investigated? Most people have their mind made up that she's guilty and will actually attack me that I have a different opinion about this. It's happened several times anywhere that I posted my thoughts on this case. People don't want her to be innocent. Even if the perpetrator were to come forward and admit to these attacks, most would stand firm. So how do you feel about that, Dickie?
I'm not aware of this horrific arm bruising that she had.
Oh, I think you were when we did it.
Was I?
The pictures were quite horrific, like her arm was black. Plus the neck wound was, you know, fairly serious. And it's a lot more than Molly did in her case.
Yeah, that's true.
And there was a lot of talk about the husband trying to get someone to rob the house to claim it on the insurance because they were in financial turmoil.
Yeah, so, okay, then we'll go along with Karen B. That she certainly has raised some questions.
Oh, yeah, I believe there are questions, and I think we've said that before. I think we've leaned toward her guilt, but there certainly are some questions there, and I think they're valid. So I definitely think that Karen's opinion is valid, and it is shared by other people.
Yeah, she's not alone out there.
No, but I do think that Darlie was really demonized by the media. For reasons that I think are unimportant and kind of frivolous, like being a blonde, getting a breast implants. I mean, leave her alone on that. Who cares? That's not relevant.
Yeah, and the thing that did the most damage was that video of the string incident at the gravesite.
Yeah, and the more I've thought about that, they had a prayer beforehand. And I really don't think that's as bad as they made it look.
No, well, you can take things out of context.
Certainly.
But I think I still believe that she is most likely guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that is based on the analysis of the blood spatters, blood stains.
Well, if you were to watch the forensic files, that's very convincing.
Yeah.
Well, but forensic files always think the person's guilty.
They are all in on that.
Yeah. But I would just say to Karen that I think both sides are valid.
Absolutely.
I think you could have either opinion and it would be reasonable. But the overwhelming opinion is that she's guilty, in most people's opinions.
And the courts, because she's run out of appeals, right?
She's on death row, yes. And I don't know if she has any more appeals. She did have a lot of people supporting her, trying to get her out, but
that
hasn't gone anywhere.
Not yet. Not to this point.
I don't think it will.
So Unchained Melody, great song.
Yeah.
Has a case suggestion. The writer says, I missed you vintage kids and glad a new episode is up. Here's a terrifying case about a female serial killer from New Hampshire named Sheila LaBarre.
Oh, we're familiar with that, aren't we?
We sure are.
That's from our old stomping grounds.
Not too far from where we lived. It was a fascinating case.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that because it isn't that well known nationwide, I believe.
No, but we might want to do that.
Yeah.
Sheila LaBarre, LaBarre, whichever, as an American convicted murderer. She was sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences with no prospect of parole after being convicted of killing 2 men, Kenneth County and Michael Deloge, in Epping, New Hampshire. Now, at the time of the crimes, she lived in Epping on a farm, and she would regularly entice younger men to her farm, where she tortured them and controlled them. At her trial, she claimed she was an angel sent by God to punish pedophiles, and she accused the 2 men that she had killed of being pedophiles.
Now, didn't she bury them on her farm?
Yeah, well, and one she tried to burn.
Oh, yeah. And they did find body parts.
Or, the fire pit or something. So
she was really nutty. Scary lady.
Yeah, if you're thinking that God sends you to punish pedophiles or punish anybody, you're a little loose in the head, right?
I would guess so, yeah. But yeah, that's a good case. That's really an unusual case. It has some interesting aspects. So Pam W. also wrote in with a case suggestion. Karen Slover was a divorced mother that was killed by her ex-husband and his family around 20 years ago. Her body was dismembered and parts were dumped into Shelbyville Lake. Many twists and turns with this case. Thank you, Pam. So Karen Hearn Slover was murdered in September of 1996 in Illinois when Karen, a 23-year-old mother of one, disappeared shortly after leaving her job as an advertising sales rep. 2 days later, authorities discovered Karen's dismembered remains wrapped in plastic bags in and near the lake. In 2002, Karen's ex-husband, Michael Slover Jr., his mother, Jeanette Slover, and his father, Michael Slover Sr., were convicted of Karen's murder, and all 3 were sentenced to 60 years in prison. Now, this case is notable for being one of the first instances of dog DNA being used as evidence in the murder trial. And I'm not sure where that comes in. Are you?
The idea was that she had been killed, and initially her remains were at a place owned by the Slovers, and they had dogs. And there were dog hairs and stuff on the body.
I see.
And they were able to, by DNA testing, match these dog hairs to the dogs that were owned by the family.
So do we know the motive why this family would want to kill this woman? Did they have kids? Was she going to leave him? What was the deal?
That's the hook here. I left some of this stuff out.
Okay. Don't want to give it all away.
No.
Okay. But it's in our list of possible to-dos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we have a case suggestion from Becky B. Would you like to read that one?
Sure. So Becky says, "Hi there. Thanks. Absolutely love your podcast and the way in which y'all present each case, which is why I figured you guys would be perfect for taking on the mysterious murder of Patsy Wright, who was the wealthy owner of the local Palace of Wax Museum. Around the time of her unusual death, the Palace of Wax burned down. When the palace burned, it contained some highly unique pieces of history, such as the original Bonnie and Clyde car. Patsy's death and the burning of the palace have remained a local mystery, which many people have now forgotten about. I'd love for you guys to take a look at the case."
Fascinating.
It is, and I'd love to do it. I had a tough time finding that much information.
Might be worth a trip.
But, well, we should keep on looking.
What state was this in?
Texas.
Oh, yeah, let's take a trip.
Okay. It's not too far from here.
No.
Around 3 in the morning, October 1987, 43-year-old Patsy Wright phoned her sister, Sally Horning, from her house in Texas. Patsy claimed she had just taken some NyQuil for sleep, but was now feeling very nauseated and was having trouble breathing. And then she suddenly collapsed in the middle of the call. Sally and her husband, Steve, rushed over to Patsy's home to help her. The front door is locked, but they were able to enter the house through Patsy's bedroom window. Patsy was lying on the bed and would not wake up, so they called for help. The paramedics arrived, but were unable to resuscitate Patsy. Autopsy performed showed traces of strychnine in Patsy's bloodstream. That's the interesting thing to me, because that's not a typical poison.
No, where do you get strychnine? Wait. Is that in any household products? Or?
No. No, it turned out that someone had poisoned her by putting strychnine in her NyQuil bottle.
And this is a woman who lived alone? Sounds like it.
As far as I know.
Huh. Yeah, I like the sound of that one. Just the whole wax museum gives it a whole horror movie feel, yeah. You know, well, the melting I wax like figures.
And I guess they had more than one museum, or she had more than one museum, and was fairly wealthy.
You'd have to be.
From these.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, strychnine.
Yeah. Do you know anything about strychnine? I have to look into it.
I would.
Yeah.
It's a muscle relaxant, right?
Don't ask me. Okay. You're the doctor.
Thanks. I thought we might look into that.
Okay. I have a comment from Karen S. on Jeffrey McDonald.
Yeah, actually, I put the last few notes or letters from people are all about the McDonald case. I think there's three people.
Okay, great.
And Karen S. has a pretty long letter, which we might edit a little bit as we go along, and we might want to comment on it sort of piece by piece,
okay.
If you know what I mean.
Well, Karen's a friend of the show who's been writing to us for a couple of years now.
Yes.
So we should give her whatever time we can.
Okay. Well, you might not say that when you start reading her letter and find out that it goes on and on and on.
Okay. Well, let's give it a whirl. Karen says, "It's been a while since we have spoken. I pride myself on being one of your very first listeners. Loved you from the first episode, and it has been a joy to hear you grow each step of the way." Thanks, Karen. "I can't imagine that either of you have a single moment's peace with all your time and effort you put into your exceptional research, writing your own scripts, recording each episode, and much more. My highest possible praise to you. I extend my warmest wishes for tremendous happiness in your new home, and congratulations on your retirement, Dick." That's
See?
So nice.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. "One day I will summon up the gumption to leave a voice message." Yay. "Regarding your latest episode about Jeffrey McDonald, I read Fatal Vision decades ago, watched the miniseries, and strongly believed that he was guilty. And then I read three more recent books, Wilderness of Error by Errol Morris, Fatal Judgment by Jerry Allen Porter and Fred Bost, The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm." Now, Janet's the one who was very critical of Fatal Vision.
Right.
Yeah. "The wealth of information presented in these books completely changed my mind. It was eye-opening. In my humble opinion, Jeffrey McDonald is innocent. I won't get into any of the specific details in this letter, or it would become a tome. At the very least, Jeffrey McDonald deserves a second trial, as the first one was abominable. So many legal errors made, shenanigans between the judge and the prosecutors, withholding exculpatory evidence, and so much more. A complete sham. Legally speaking, Jeffrey McDonald has not been treated fairly. Far from it. And why keep denying DNA testing? What earthly sense does that make? Sheesh. And as far as I'm concerned, the crime scene was so completely botched from the beginning that most evidence discovered there should not have been given any weight. Crowds of people in the home, when the scene had not been sealed, could have spread the fibers around, blood around, objects around. I could go on and on. There had never before been any domestic abuse, and he was not known to be violent. He was a hands-on dad who deeply adored and loved his daughters and wife, despite the affairs, which I don't condone. I can't imagine him suddenly doing something so horrendous. Regarding his pajama top not being worn in his children's rooms, CID officer seeing Helena Stokely on the corner in the rain as he first went to McDonald home after the 911 call. You want to comment on that before I go on?
Let me just sneak in here. I got some other things to say, too. But,
okay.
It was never proven that it was Helena Stokely. They said that they saw someone who might have matched the description of the woman that McDonald described in the house. But there's nothing that said it was Helena Stokely.
Okay.
So I don't know about that.
What else do you want to say?
Well, I would just say, and we'll talk some more, obviously. I have read Wilderness of Error. I haven't read the other ones. And I probably should read The Journalist and the Murderer.
Well, and you read the outtake from The New Yorker.
Yeah. The books are compelling, or the book that I read, Wilderness of Error, is compelling, but I still don't think it changes the guilt of Jeffrey McDonald. It's certainly Fatal Vision was biased in one way, but these other books, or Morris's book, is biased in the other direction. So it's kind of like pick and choose what you believe.
Well, yeah, all you can do is read everything and then decide what your opinion is.
Yes, and the crime scene certainly was botched, but you can't deny the blood spatters and the blood evidence. And fortunately for the prosecution, everybody in the family had a different blood type. So you could very easily see where the blood types were found and get deductions from that.
Right. Well, there was some DNA evidence that was done, actually.
There was. That's the next letter.
And there was nothing found from Helena Stokely.
Right. But well, you're going to read that one next.
So Karen went on to say that she's not trying to sway anyone's mind, but she would just suggest that if you've taken the time to read Fatal Vision, you should also read three books listed above, starting with The Wilderness of Air. Richly thought-provoking and well worth your time. At least you will have both sides of the story on which to base your opinion. On a different note, I hope that someday in your feedback section, you will tell us various things about how you create each podcast. For example, how many hours of research go into each week's podcast? How long does it take you to write your awesome scripts? How did you get into podcasting? And anything else about you that you would like to share? Your listeners eagerly await the answers. That would be a treat. Oh, and before I sign off, Jill, please regale us with your wonderful story behind Tie Grabber and how such a beautiful, lovely couple found your start. I can't do that.
Well,
I don't like to talk about myself, really, but I appreciate your comments. It's really sweet.
All I would say to that is that the story behind Tie Grabber is mostly true.
Yes.
How's that?
Yeah, totally. And as far as the things we do to create each podcast, quite a bit of time goes into it, actually. It can be pretty rigorous. I would say at least 10 to 20 hours of research.
And it, I mean, well, some of them flow pretty quickly and some of them are a long slog.
Yeah.
Trying to get things done.
Well, and it depends how much information is out there. How much do you have to dig? Do you have to make phone calls and talk to people? Is there enough on the internet that you can just kind of throw it together? It depends.
Well, and I don't think we've done an episode yet where we haven't missed something. We always get feedback from people that suggest things could have been looked at differently.
Oh, of course. And how we got into podcasting is pretty simple. I just enjoyed listening to podcasts. And I thought, well, I'd like to talk about true crime. And I know that Dick likes beer, and we just kind of threw that together.
Yeah, as incongruous as it sounds.
Yeah. So anyway, but I just kind of feel like it was meant to be, because I really enjoy it now. It's my full-time job, and I love it.
We're enjoying it quite a bit.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to work together, too, especially now that you don't have to work full-time as a physician.
Retirement is great.
Yeah.
So thank you, Karen.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Karen.
Okay, now I got another comment from Ms. Journey Fan, and she says, DNA doesn't lie.
So this is the other side of it.
This is the other side.
Okay.
In 1999, McDonald won the right to have DNA testing done on crime scene evidence in an attempt to link Helena Stokely and Greg Mitchell to the murders of Colette, Kristen, and Kimberly. DNA tests were performed on samples from Stokely and Mitchell, and in 2006, the results of these tests ruled both of them out as contributors of the hairs found on or near the victims. And guess who those hairs belonged to? You got it, Jeffrey McDonald. A hair from one of his arms was found clutched in Colette's left hand. That hair is bloody, broken, and located next to a splinter from the club. Considering that the left sleeve of McDonald's pajama top was torn down to the cuff, one could argue that Colette used her left hand to rip a hair from her husband's exposed left arm. She ends with saying, he did it. He butchered his pregnant wife and two little girls. Period.
So she has a strong opinion in the opposite direction.
She's a little bit different. Yep.
Yeah, there was a lot of evidence, wasn't there?
Oh, there was. And this case is 40 years old, almost 50 years old now.
Well, and right? I think that's why it's so popular and interesting.
And it continues to be popular.
Because there's so much to it.
There's a lot to it, and there's so much that you can learn about it.
Well, and I'm just so pliable that I read Karen's letter, and I think, maybe he is innocent. Then I read Ms. Journey Fan, and I'm like, well, God damn it, he is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So I can go either way on things.
Yeah, and not that this is a litmus test, but all appeals have been denied.
And just common sense-wise, why would anyone else want to kill his family?
Well,
I mean, really.
Those stoned-out hippies.
But then why wouldn't they have killed him?
Well, you're getting back to our episode again.
I know. But he just really, his injuries were so minor.
Yeah, so this, if you've listened to the episode today about Molly and Tom Corbett Martins, the story that they told was inconsistent with the lack of injuries, or the story they told wasn't consistent with their normal exams.
Sure.
How do I put that? It doesn't sound right. The story that Tom and Molly gave didn't jibe with their physical findings. And I think the same thing goes with Jeffrey.
Right. But then I think of who was the guy in Boston who shot himself and shot his pregnant wife?
Charles Stewart.
Yeah. So he went all out, right? He shot himself, but he still got caught.
Yeah. But there is some evidence that he certainly wasn't trying to shoot himself as severely as he did. And there was a question of whether his wife, as she was dying, bumped into him and caused the gun to go off in a different direction.
Well, then we could go to Darlie. And Darlie gave herself some pretty serious injuries if she's guilty.
Yeah. So
it doesn't seem to matter how many injuries you have.
But when you look at the injuries to Colette and the two kids, that were absolutely horrible injuries. And what did McDonald have? Well, the worst one was the cut on the chest that resulted in a small pneumothorax.
Which seemed to be done with surgical precision.
Right. And he's a doctor. Anyway.
Anyway, sorry, Karen, but I do lean towards the guiltiness.
We're getting too involved in discussing the case again.
Yeah, well, let's not go through it all again. We have one more comment from Charlotte.
Yeah, this I put this in just because it was a good learning thing.
Okay.
So she said, just listened to your podcast about Mac and enjoyed it a bunch. Wanted to let you know that the reason he tested negative for any drugs was because at the time amphetamines were not against the law and drug labs didn't even test for the presence of them.
Uh-huh.
So he could have been full of amphetamines and it never would have shown up in the lab report. Just FYI.
That's a great piece of information.
Isn't
we
it?
Didn't know that.
No.
And that makes more sense to me because I really did think he was, you know, on the amphetamines just because he was working so much. And then he said he was reading and watching TV after working for 30 hours. It just, such an overachiever.
Yeah, they had dinner, they watched TV for a while. He did the dishes. He sat back down to read some more and watch
TV. According to him, we don't know what really happened. But
so, instead of going to bed. Anyway.
But he did do a lot of stuff and he just lost some weight.
And I think that was McGinnis's theory, was that he was pumped full of amphetamines and that he and his wife had an argument, and that resulted in what happened.
Well, Karen said that McGinnis did some shady things. Do you know what she's talking about?
Yeah, in a sense. I know that he's been caught bending the truth. He was sued by McDonald and settled the suit. Paid McDonald, what, $300,000?
Something, yeah. Yeah.
McGinnis isn't the choir boy.
No, but his book is very damning.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, so much for your feedback. I really enjoyed this feedback segment. It was interesting.
Oh,
I enjoyed it a lot. Good job putting it together.
Glad you like it.
And good job to everyone who contributed.
Yeah. So as we say, keep those voicemails coming.
We do need voicemails.
We love those.
We love the emails, but the voicemails are extra special.
They are.
So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we're going to see you next time at the Quiet End.
We will. Save you a seat.
Bye-bye.
Bye.